On the 19th of July 2011, Rupert Murdoch, head of the global media empire News Corporation, was called before a UK parliamentary committee with his son James to answer questions in relation to the phone hacking scandal.
As for my comments, Mr. Chairman, and my statement, which I believe was around the closure of the News of the World newspaper.
Before you get to that, I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
Okay, thank you.
The statement around the closure of the News of the World newspaper, where I stated that...
For many watching, the hacking of people's phones in the name of getting headlines was a serious breach of journalism ethics, not to mention breaking the law. The implications would send a shockwave around the world.
For media nerds like me, it was completely fascinating, and I absolutely think it was a turning point in media history. Yes, I agree with you, it was a well-rehearsed line, which doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't true. I thought Murdoch looked shattered, absolutely shattered and broken. In fact, I think he looked every day of his 80 years, and I think what we saw was the end of the Murdoch era.
Media commentator Margaret Simons, and we'll hear more from her later. But first, let's talk to somebody with a bit of a background in the British press. Andrew Jaspin is a journalist who began his career in the UK. He was the editor for The Age in Australia and is now the editor of The Conversation.
I worked at the Sunday Times and Times in the mid to late 80s, and this was going on then, so I wasn't at all surprised. And let me explain to you what happens. I always equate London as being a bit of a pressure cooker when it comes to journalism. You've got a fierce number of papers. Every morning you can buy about a dozen daily newspapers, servicing a declining market. So you've got newspaper sales coming down, everybody trying to compete, and also at the same time the resources for each of the newsrooms is being reduced, so you've got fewer reporters, fewer investigative reporters, etc. So I think what's happened, and this is my own analysis, is that because I knew it was going on in the late 80s, and what was happening at the Sunday Times, for example, is private detectives were being hired, you know, to do this kind of work. So it wasn't actually done by journalists, because journalists didn't have the equipment, because you needed quite sophisticated equipment to be able to eavesdrop and all that sort of stuff. And also, a lot of these people were ex-coppers, by the way, whose job was to monitor phones and all that. So they knew how to get around it. They could ring up their mates and plug them in, and all this sort of stuff was going on. As you probably know, there's a, particularly in Fleet Street, but the same thing happens here, I'm sure. There's very close relationships between certain coppers who sell information to their favoured outlets, and those favoured outlets tend to be the ones with the most money. So in the case of the News of the World, I think they just wanted more exclusives. They had more money than most other papers. And if you ever looked at the News of the World website, it said we pay well for tip-offs. It sort of gave an example. If you get a front page story, typically we might pay you £25,000. But the beauty of phone hacking was instead of having to spend weeks or months on a story, you just listen into a phone call and you get a story, particularly if you listen into the right ones. Now, there are something like 3,500 people's phones were being hacked or listened into, so that potentially is 3,500 plus exclusives. So that was part of it. But to answer your question, I think part of that all comes down to the cultures of newspapers. There was a culture which was lax at News International, News Corporation. And that lax culture was people just turned a blind eye to it all, pretended it didn't happen, and hoped that nobody would notice. Unfortunately for them all, The Guardian kept working away at this. A guy called Nick Davies kept chipping away, and you know, finally the story came out.
So how does the Australian media compare to the UK? It can be argued that Australia owes a lot of its journalistic style to the British papers, but we also have an imbalanced ownership, with Rupert Murdoch's News Limited owning 70% of Australian newspapers. Robert Mann is a professor of politics at La Trobe University and the author of a quarterly essay titled Bad News, in which he looks at Murdoch's influence in Australia through the press, particularly his flagship publication, The Australian.
It was a very bad decision to allow Murdoch in the late 1980s to take control of 70% of the important statewide national press. And that's still the case. And it seems to me that given that Murdoch is a political animal with a very strong set of neoconservative and neoliberal values, it was an astonishing mistake to allow him to have such influence. If you live, for example, in Brisbane, all you get is either the Courier Mail, which is a Murdoch paper, or the Australian, which is a Murdoch paper. Mm. The same in Adelaide, you get a Murdoch paper and the Australian. in Sydney and Melbourne, you have a choice between Fairfax, but a huge tabloid, either the Daily Telegraph or the Herald Sun, plus the Australian. The first Murdoch problem is the fact that a very political animal with a very strong set of beliefs has control of 70% of the Australian press. But I think the second Murdoch problem is the Australian, because of its influence in the political class and because of the kind of mission it has, I think, to bring down governments like the Gillard government because of its relation to the Greens and because it did, I think, play a role in undermining the Rudd government. So I think we have two Murdoch problems.
Do you think the Australian's an ethical newspaper?
No. I mean, journalists are ethical on it, but I think there's too much that's happened in the way it's reported things that it would be wrong to think of it as ethical. I think it twists news. I think it often begins with a conclusion and then searches for evidence to prove it. It kind of knows too much in advance. It targets individuals. It bears grudges. It boasts about its own performance. It's contemptuous of its rivals. None of these things seem to me to be consistent with any idea of ethics. If I read, as I do every day now, electronically, the New York Times and read The Australian, I have to say one seems to me to be an ethical paper and the other just doesn't.
Many who engage with the Australian media are now questioning how ethics are approached. Let's hear from author, media commentator and director of the Centre for Advanced Journalism at the University of Melbourne, Margaret Simons.
Well, I think there are problems with ethics in Australia. I think we've seen gross invasions of privacy at various times. We've seen conflict of interest, representing commercial interests without proper declarations. And underlying all of these, I think there is a great lack of awareness of what the codes of ethics say, both the Australian Journalists Association Code of Ethics and also the ones that are written by the employers, including the News Limited Code of Professional Conduct. The codes themselves are pretty good. But if you walk into most newsrooms and ask people what they say, you'd get very few people who knew. It's not policed. The penalties, if you do get pinged for it, are basically a slap over the wrist. And most of the clauses are well and truly open to interpretation. And there is also an overriding guidance clause which says that any other clause can be overwritten if the public interest demands it. I'm not necessarily against any of that. And almost any other approach raises problems, but I don't think you can call it a strict code of ethics at all. I think it's a pretty slack code of ethics, frankly. But in terms of the public interest, yeah, it's very much in the eye of the beholder. Generally speaking, it's taken to mean not only what the public are interested in, but something which they have a legitimate interest in, which actually influences or affects them in some way. But exactly what that means is certainly open to argument. Channel 7, for example, which breached the privacy of that MP, David Campbell, by outing him, argued that that was in the public interest because he was a government minister. Well, I don't agree with that, but you can argue it both ways. So what is the public interest is something which we need to think about a great deal more, I think.
Do Australian journalists need to be re-educated in what it means to be an ethical...
Well, educated. And it's not enough for a company to put out a code of ethics, or a union for that matter, to put out a code of ethics and leave it at that. There needs to be ongoing ethical training, there needs to be leadership that walks the talk, that behaves as though these things are taken seriously. And we haven't had any of that. I mean, I know from my own experience in newsrooms that there are chiefs of staff who are actually against teaching cadets and junior reporters the code of ethics because they don't want to have to argue with them. They just want to be able to tell them what to do. And they say, well, later when they're older, then they can get ethical. So, in fact, the reverse has happened in many newsrooms. We've had leadership which behaves as though the code of ethics is a bit inconvenient or should only be followed in those occasions when it doesn't stop you from getting the story.
In light of recent scrutiny, an inquiry has been announced which examines aspects of the print and online media, including ways of strengthening the effectiveness of the Australian Press Council. Richard Ackland, journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald and former host of ABC's Media Watch, on the inquiry.
Look, I suspect it's come out of some sort of political resentment. To some extent, there was bad publicity for the government coming from the Murdoch press. There was obvious resentment about that, and particularly quite strong attacks on the Greens. You know, obviously there was quite a determined idea to have a look at the media, but precisely what they wanted to do was never clear, and I don't think that was clear in their own minds. Having said that, I suppose there are some serious issues to look at. Privacy is one of them. Media codes of conduct they will probably take up most of the airspace with this inquiry. But we've already got media codes of conduct. What sort of mechanism will be put in place to give whatever body it's going to be some teeth? I think the media is legitimately concerned about some aspects of it. I know Julian Disney from the Press Council is wanting to expand Press Council power base and authority and capacity to discipline the print media and probably even rope in some of the broadcast media as well. These are the sort of fanciful ideas that are being floated around at the moment. What sort of body is going to do all this, and how's it going to work? Who's going to fund it? Does the funding compromise it? At the moment, the Press Council's funded by the newspapers, so News Limited, say, puts a lot of money into it. Does that somehow or other compromise the independence of the Press Council? If the government puts the money in it, it's very difficult. Obviously, it needs industry support, but it needs wise people with an interest in a free press to do these things.
The effectiveness of the inquiry is yet to be seen, but what remains undeniable is that journalism and the media are changing. There will always be a need for the news. The question is, how will we get it and who will provide it? Margaret Simons.
I think we're going to go through a very difficult and bloody time over the next 5 to 10 years, because I think we are going to lose most of our newspapers over that period, certainly in hard copy form. And though they will continue as mastheads in electronic form, they will not be supporting anything like the staff they presently have. And so that represents a massive loss of journalistic capacity. And we haven't got the alternatives there yet. They are coming. Some of them are already there. But nothing like enough to replace that sort of journalistic capacity. But I take heart from the fact that all human societies have always had professional messengers, even before the printing press. And I think that there is absolutely no evidence of declining appetite for news and information. Quite the reverse. It's never been higher. And I'm quite confident that society will find ways of informing itself. It won't only be professional journalists, though. It will also be a matter of journalists working together with the citizenry, with an engaged and empowered citizenry through use of social media and other tools. And that, in many ways, will be healthier. The worrying thing is the sort of hard yards of journalism, if you like, the stuff that nobody does unless they get paid for it. Reading reams of boring documents, going and interviewing people who don't particularly want to hear from you and making them angry. But even just stuff that makes people cross, you know, it's not fun. Citizen journalists will report things which directly affect them. They will report things in which they have a vested interest. And all of that's good and important and will continue and become more important, but it's not enough. You also need the disinterested reporter who is nevertheless going to go there and do the dirty work and the hard and dirty work of journalism. And that won't be done consistently and with experience and integrity unless we can find a way to pay people, not vast amounts. Nobody goes into journalism to make megabucks, but enough to pay the mortgage and raise the kids.